Listen, there's a great work to be done. As soon as you win this court battle, you must deliver this message. Take advantage of this opportunity and declare a powerful message to this world. He expects more of us. He believes we can do more. Who's going to stop Christ? Who's going to stop Christ from getting this work done?
This is Behind the Work.
Welcome to Behind the Work. I'm Grant Turgeon. We're broadcasting to you live today from the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus here in Edmond, Oklahoma. You can get all of the church radio shows at kpcg.fm. And that list of shows includes a new history show called Rewind Repeat. And if you regularly scroll through the shows and you check for new programs, you might have noticed that on Friday, two new episodes of that program went up. And so today we're going to be talking to the host of Rewind Repeat, a history podcast, Mr. David V. Hill. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Mr. Turgeon.
And I must say, you're one of the very few people who has ever volunteered to come on the show at various times, like if there's something going on. And so I know if I ever ask you, I don't have to really worry about you being worried about it. So that really helps.
Always fun to talk about history too.
Definitely. And I just listened to both of those programs from Friday. They're both about Antiochus. And I must tell you, I was really gripped by it, and I was even getting chills. I was getting worked up emotionally at times with some of the graphic details that you went through, because this is some history that is really bloody and disturbing at times. And just to see what human beings are willing to do just to get power and keep power and expand power, it's pretty extreme.
Yes. The whole story around Antiochus just has so many wonderful lessons about human nature like that, and then spiritually just holds a lot of lessons for us today. And I think Mr. Fleury's been working really hard to help us understand how deep Satan's hatred is for us and his people, and for God's people, and for even physical Israel. So you get that hatred really put on display when you go through that history there. And I think it's important for us to have that kind of emotional reaction to it, because not only does it help us understand about human nature, but it also protects us spiritually as we fight in this war against Satan.
Right. That's a great point. The parallels to us today, especially spiritually, are pretty extensive. You actually built on your five-part series, your first one about Charlemagne, and Charlemagne and Antiochus are pretty well connected because they both have those ties to the Holy Roman Empire, because we understand Antiochus, there's one yet to come to lead the Holy Roman Empire too. So just a lot of, like I said, a pretty brutal history, savage history, and it really does impact the whole world. And something that makes your show unique, and you've pretty much already alluded to this, is that you actually get God's perspective on the history. You can't find another show that actually tells the history honestly. That's another thing, actually telling the true history, and then getting into what the Bible prophesied about those events, and also what Mr. Gerald Fleury has said. So just a really helpful resource.
Yes, yeah, so that's all baked in the name of the show too, just Rewind, Repeat. You go back in history, and then you see how that history helps illustrate the prophecies that are coming. And then I really just use whatever Mr. Gerald Fleury or the church has written about that history and the prophecy as a way to just anchor the whole show and the lessons behind it. And of course, Mr. Fleury has written a lot about Antiochus, and so I was able to pull out some, I think, really great quotes for the second and third episodes of the series. I did have in mind too that potentially it could be used for Watch Jerusalem, so I didn't get to use like the New Testament necessarily, or some of the things that would directly relate to our spiritual war right now. But I think anyone in the church listening to it can meditate on it and think about all the things that Mr. Fleury has written about it in our relation to the spiritual war right now, and the things that you read in Thessalonians and in Jude and in Peter, all those great prophecies and warnings there as well. But I definitely anchor it around there. The whole point is just to get the Bible's perspective on the history. And it's kind of funny, but I think about, like, the show as a resource for even people in the world tomorrow. You know, you think about if you have the history there from the Bible's perspective, it never gets outdated. Even if some facts come to light that might explain it better, or maybe certain things that we don't have full understanding on. But if you have it from God's perspective, it's always there, right? And it's always accurate. So, yeah, that's I think that's the most exciting thing about the show, is that you're seeing the history, you're learning from it, and then you can just immediately apply it to the prophecies that we're reading about today and what Mr. Fleury's trying to teach us into our spiritual lives.
That's a good point about just how timeless these episodes are. That's something that really stood out to me while listening to this. It doesn't matter if you listen to these today or 10 years from now, the history still stands and it still relates to us, no matter what is going on in the world at the time of our listening. So that's something really helpful, and something about history that is pretty unique compared to a lot of subjects. History is what it is. It's there, it's recorded, and we just have to find the true aspects. That's how you opened this series about Antiochus. You talked about light. That's where perhaps God's church does it differently from anyone else, because we have that ultimate light, that perspective from God that really does shine and give us the right way of looking at something, or it kind of points out what history is most important, even, mm-hmm. or even just what aspects of specific history to look at. And I love the way that you got into how today it's just moral relativism. People don't really want to be too absolute about what is right and what is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the thing. When you talk about light and dark, you just have to value the light so much. And I think one of the things I've been thinking about a lot the last year is just how precious Mr. Drelfler's example was when the church fell away, and he was the only one in there just standing up for it, with Mr. Amos, of course, the only two right there. But the people standing up for that light, they valued it and they treasured it so much. And you see that kind of thinking even in America's founding, when they founding fathers and talk about what they wanted to do, the experiment they set up in the United States, and how you need people that treasure that in order to defend it and fight for it. And so it's the same way with us today. You have the light, and if you really view it as light and then you treasure it, then you're not going to let anyone try to darken it or compromise with it, and you're not going to let things like moral relativism sneak in your life or your thinking there.
Exactly. And another valuable part of this show, specifically this Antiochus series that you're doing, is that you give a wide scope. You give us all of the background information leading up to the emergence of Antiochus Epiphanes. So you talked about history that took place hundreds of years before with Alexander the Great and the Greek Empire that he was in the midst of really building to power until he died early. Maybe you could just give us some of the highlights of that history and how it actually did lead to Antiochus emerging.
Sure. Yes. It's actually one of the hardest things to do is figure out when to start the story, but I went there because of just the amazing history that Josephus has about what happened in that. So King Alexander came to conquer the Persian Empire around the 330s BCE. And when he came across the Jews, he was asking of them to submit to his authority, and the Jews wouldn't do it because they had given an oath of loyalty to the Persian emperor, and he wasn't dead yet. And so Alexander was really upset about that and had basically promised that he was going to destroy them. So when he finally came down to them, everyone was expecting that he was going to destroy the Jerusalem and the Jews, but God had worked it out with like this amazing miracle where he actually showed Alexander, the high priest, before he even started in his conquest of Persia. So the Jews, led by the high priest, just cried out to God for deliverance and prayed to him and asked, you know, whatever you have us do, to save Jerusalem will do it. And so God told him to basically have all the priests and the high priests and the lead of them come out in their priestly garbs and have the whole city march out and welcome Alexander, which is, if you think about it, just quite the act of faith for you to open up your city and proceed out to this king that just promised you destruction. But they did that. They followed God's instruction there. When Alexander saw that, he was amazed by that. He remembered the dream with the high priest, that in that dream he was told he was going to be successful in conquering Persia. So he completely 100% reversed his reaction and just praised the Jews and kept their allowed them to keep their laws and just welcomed them in with open arms. So that history is just so valuable. You rarely hear about it. I started with that because I thought it'd be so helpful for everybody to see, especially as a compare and contrast between the high priest at that time versus the high priest just like 150 years later, that unfortunately didn't look to God and didn't keep the God's way of life going. So he conquers the Persian Empire, and then he dies, like you said, recently, fairly soon after he does that. And in the wake of that, he didn't have any heir set in place. They're all either too young or not fully legitimate. I think the most legitimate heir was basically still in the womb. And so the big generals of the army basically carved out territories in the remaining Persian Empire. And you have the break. Now, Bible prophecy says there's four major ones, and I didn't have time to get into that in the second episode. I wanted to basically stay on the main story. I think that was kind of a lesson I learned in the five-part series. I think I got a little lost in the detail there, but I didn't want to overwhelm people with too much of that. But there was four main breaks, and the two biggest breaks were the king of the south and the king of the north, the two biggest areas of the remaining parts of the Greek Empire. So the king of the south is based in Egypt, the king of the north is based in Syria, and right in the middle is Jerusalem. And so these kings were all fighting with each other. I said that basically the Greeks were committing suicide because they would not submit to each other, and that the generals would fight continually to try to basically become the next Alexander, but none of them could because they're not strong enough. But you did have certain kings that got pretty close to it, and then the Romans would come and kind of mess their plans up. But right in the middle between the king of the north and king of the south is Jerusalem. And so the kings kind of, I think, control of Jerusalem switches back like five or six times, and eventually king of the north gains control of it, and Antiochus the fourth comes on the scene, and he makes his bid to try to become the next Alexander. The Romans stop him, and he's just so upset with what happened there, and he's also basically been I think actually deceived by the high priest at that time to thinking that he could Hellenize the Jews. And so there's just a lot of things going on. The Jews, by reason of their transgression and lawlessness, basically invite him in, and he just basically wipes them out in Jerusalem and sets up pagan pig worship and idolatry and all that going on there.
Yeah, that's a really great summary. Thanks a lot for doing that. That history of Antiochus is really so fascinating because even before he took power, there was a lot of intrigue and suspense, betrayal, murder, and then he's in charge. And it seemed like that's sort of the same process he went through before he betrayed the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Like he tricked them into thinking that maybe he would help, and then he just walked into the city because the high priest at the time opened it up.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just comes right in and slaughters everyone. It seems like a really satanic way of doing things. He was obviously a maniac. He was insane. But at the same time, he was subtle enough to conceal his true intentions until he could really wreak the most havoc possible.
Yeah, I think you see that instability even when he's a young child. It's kind of interesting. You get all this history from the Greeks. Not a whole lot, but you get one or two accounts. But you get enough of it to know from those people that they consider him mad, insane as well. So it's not like this is just something the Jews came up with because they got squashed by him for a
right.
while. This was everybody, contemporaries, saying he was insane. And I think it's a lot like one of the things that I think about a lot is the fact that even with the United States and the Antiochus that we had in power for a while there, it's not like you get any big displays of like, oh, this guy's possessed or influenced by Satan. They're just, they look normal, but you have to look at their actions and you see what they do. And then you see, okay, there's a spirit behind that and that comes from Satan. And you get that with Antiochus. Obviously, he was charming and he was able to deceive and lie to people. And there's no outward display that this guy was just a maniac. But then once he got in power, then you see he just becomes more open about that. And just manages to lie his way into power and do all sorts of different things through that. And for a while, even trying to take control of Egypt was all under a big lie. So pretty much every part of his policy was founded on him lying to the people he was going to be dealing with.
It's interesting that you bring up that idea of like people just caring more about words or maybe just like that surface appearance than they do about deeds, about actual actions that are taking place, because that, like you just showed there, it goes back thousands of years. People have always been seduced by empty words. People always are influenced by words that are not backed up by any meaningful action at all. And that's how it is today. It's how it was back then. And it's such a destructive trap to fall into. I mean, I think a pretty clear example today is in the United States. People get so upset anytime the president rebukes a reporter or says anything on Twitter they don't like. Meanwhile, they're okay with the most extreme behaviors. I mean, late-term abortion is something that those same people who get offended about the president's words are totally fine with.
Yeah.
They're fine with barbaric torture tactics being used on the unborn. Meanwhile, they get upset about words.
Yeah, it's just one big just tragedy, really. I mean, you just look at, this is Satan's society, and Satan's the father of lies, and that's how he operates on. And I think the story illustrates that. I mean, there's, in the second episode, I make the point that there is no reason for the Jews to ever have trusted him. There's nothing in Antiochus's reign that would have given any evidence that you could trust this guy, but they still did. And then they got, you know, punished for it, of course.
I think another thing that you brought out that showed why they might have been susceptible to his attack was that they had already pretty much been losing this war of ideas. They had already been giving in to these principles of Hellenism. You kind of showed that if the Jews had been more separate from the ways of the world around them, they would have been united and would have refused to compromise with any of these other powers. They dealt with a lot of real threats, like you mentioned with Alexander. They had to open up and show that they were willing to talk with him, and they had to step out on faith to do that. But there were real threats all around them. The Roman Empire that could pretty much thwart anyone else's ambitions with one letter sent by a diplomat or the words of one diplomat. Egypt, the king of the north, like you said, all of these powers surrounding them, all of these threats. And so, yeah, it is really fascinating to think about that.
Yeah, it's just exactly like our own spiritual war, where we're always fighting, and that basically you get the idea that some of them just got tired of fighting and they just wanted to conform and be accepted. And of course, that's what caused their destruction. But that was one of the more interesting things about that history of Antiochus that I didn't realize years ago, but he was definitely the guy that was there that was going to try to destroy them, but he got invited in. And I didn't really think about that even reading Mr. Fleury's literature as much, but you have a lot of evidence that just shows that he wouldn't have done any of that. He would not have thought to do it or been given the opportunity to if they had stayed united and clean and pure, because he was basically playing off of the family of the high priest, or people are basically saying, hey, we could do this for you. We could get this done and get you more money. If none of them had done that, it would have been a different situation.
Right. And I just love that you got into this concept of how ideas are dangerous. They're more dangerous than all of these menacing world-ruling empires that surrounded the Jews. Different empires battling for control, and the Jews were right in the middle. But the thing that was their biggest threat was giving into these Hellenistic ideas, and like you mentioned, just people who had no morals, like the skeptics who thought that values and morals were pretty much meaningless. Mm-hmm. And it's the same today. It reminded me of the May, June 2017 Philadelphia Trumpet News magazine. I went back in the archives and I found that cover. It said the world's most powerful weapon, and it had tanks and bombs on there on the cover. But the article says it is over 1,000 times more destructive than the biggest bomb ever detonated. And then basically Andrew Miller talks about how it's not a bomb that is our biggest threat. It's an ideology that proposes that there is no such thing as right and wrong. And that is what really ends up destroying people.
Yeah. Yeah. There's just so many parallels with today and what happened back then. And I didn't want to get too much into the philosophy itself, but you look at the ideas presented by the Greeks and the ideas presented to us today, and they're the same ideas. They have different labels. And I think that's kind of one of the lies about modern society, is that we're evolving to something better and that we're coming up with different solutions and new ideas, but it's all the same stuff. It's evolution before it's called evolution. It's moral relativism before it's called moral relativism. And so that's what I found so interesting about this story, is that the Jews back then are confronted with the same issues that we've been confronted, the church has been confronted in the last 25 years. And today we have to fight the ideas that come in and weaken our faith towards God. We have to fight the ideas that basically move us away from God, because it opens up maybe temptation to basically either stop fighting or to let down. Or, you know, that article that we're reminded about year after year, like, what is a liberal in the Church of God? Someone who goes as far as they can without crossing over the line. You know, that's basically all the same things that they're dealing with. But the thing is, if you let any of that in, then you're pretty much, if you continue down that path, if you don't repent about that, you're done for.
Yeah, we know a couple of really dangerous ideas like evolution or communism. Maybe you could just explain briefly what Hellenism was and how that was such a destructive way of thinking and doing things that was a real threat to the Jews.
Okay, yeah. So when Alexander conquered the Persian Empire, he wanted to do something a little bit different. So normally what would happen is if you came in, you would clean out all the old thoughts, the old religion, set up yourself completely as a new dynasty, new thing. But he actually wanted to take the Greeks and the Persians, basically combine their cultures to create something new, where you take, in his mind, would be the best of both worlds. And that's what we call basically Hellenism, this infusion of Greek thought combined with even some of the Persian way of doing things. That came with not just like, when I say thoughts, like philosophy, it's like your art, your culture, like all those things, what would comprise civilization. And when the Greeks took over, they were imposing that, or actually Alexander wanted to impose it everywhere and combine it. When he died, the Greeks that succeeded him basically said, we're not going to do that, but they did still impose the Greek stuff. It was just mostly on the aristocracy. So the upper levels of power, if you wanted to have access to power and to wealth, you basically had to know Greek and adopt all those customs. So for the Jews, what was tempting is by adopting all that, then they could have access to more power and wealth and security, or so they thought. And what makes it dangerous is that all these ideas are, they all have their roots in paganism. They all basically are derived from old Babylonian paganism. Now, the world views the Greeks as the ones that started it, but they got that from the Egyptians, and the Egyptians got that from the Babylonians. So it's all paganism, and it would do things like it would remove the significance or value of human life. That was one thing I brought up there. It would put more focus on the visual and less on the function. It would remove, it would be basically rejection of the divine. A lot of those philosophers are basically just done with that. But the interesting thing is it all kind of mixes and kind of melts together in some ways, like the when you look at the Catholic Church and all that, you see that ultimately the pagan religions overcame some of that stuff, and you get the Catholic Church to a certain degree. But the thing I didn't really, one of the things I want to understand more is whenever you hear about people describe Western civilization, is we all openly admit that it's a mix between Greek thought and basically Hebrew thought or Judaic Christian values. And so a lot of people would even say that it's basically just Greek thought with like Judaic morals. And so they would elevate Greek thought and Greek philosophy over the philosophy and thought that God shows through the Bible that is correct. And so some of this was just me trying to understand where the two met, why people thought or think today Greek philosophy and thought so important to Western civilization, and see where they're wrong on that. Because obviously they are. We're not going to have that in the world tomorrow. And so that's kind of the other thing about this, is our Western civilization is described as a mixing of the two. And I just wanted to show where actually the solution is not from mixing. The solution is actually removing the Greek pagan thought and staying pure to what God reveals in his Bible.
It's interesting. Someone actually sent me a quote yesterday. It totally unrelated from the fact that I was getting ready to interview you. And it's from Thomas Sowell. He had a book titled Intellectuals and Society. And at one point he talks about this concept of one day at a time rationalism. So it's where basically intellectuals appoint themselves as the chief authority in place of God. And then at that point, there's no such thing as logic that can stand the test of time. It logic doesn't last for centuries. Truth is not the same over a long period of time. It's just the people in charge day by day can change their minds, and that's what everyone under them has to go with. That's what we see with the coronavirus shutdowns around the world. This is totally unprecedented, forcing everyone to stay home when they're not even sick and it shouldn't even have to be quarantined. It's just because a couple people in a health organization said that had to be what happened. It doesn't even have any basis. It doesn't have any precedent. The stats don't even really back up what's going on. But because someone in charge said it, that's what you have to go with.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's not even clear you can trust the stats, too.
No.
You know, you can't trust it from China. And then you have to wonder, even the United States, even the way they come up with the fatality rate, I think, as far as I know, I haven't looked into it completely, but it's like different what they're doing with coronavirus than they do with influenza, which would, if they did the same thing, would drop the fatality rate even lower. So yeah, it's just amazing to me to think that like our society, there's the intellectuals in there, they turn to the Greeks as like their source and their beginning foundation of wisdom and thinking and proper logic and way of thought and all that. And more, basically, what they want to see is the removal of the Judaic Christian values out of that mix, so that all you're left is Greek thought. But you look at the history and you see where did Greek thought lead to? Was there any republic, any democracy, any even military dictatorship in Greece that lasted? And it didn't. So it's inevitable. If you're just adopting Greek thought, you're going to end up the way the Greeks did, subjugated by the Romans.
Exactly. Yeah, well, it's been great talking to you. Maybe we could just conclude with a couple of recommendations that you have for people who don't read history. What's something they could get into?
Sure. Well, I always think the first thing is to look at what era you're interested in, and then from there you can pick a book. So like if you're interested in American history, I like Paul Johnson's A History of American People. If you're interested in British history or Churchill, Manchester, his biography on Churchill is really great. So you want to start at some point of this is an area I'm interested in, and then from there move on. I think what's really helpful these days is you have like Goodreads recommendations and all that. So even if you narrow down the topic and you just Google like the best books, you'll get a lot of good feedback. Like this book has a lot more facts, but this book is more interesting on the storytelling. And I think when you're first starting, you want to definitely get into the more interesting on the storytelling to keep your interest peaked and going while you embark on your study of the history there.
Well, Mr. Vigil, thanks so much for coming on today. I've been speaking with Rewind Repeat podcast host David Vigil. This is Behind the Work. Thanks so much for listening today.
You've been listening to Behind the Work. Email your thoughts to comments at kpcg.fm. Listen for a new episode each Monday at 11:30 a.m. Central Time.